Welcome to the New Books Network Journalism Podcast to mark 150 years of The Nation magazine. The Nation began publishing in July 1865. It's the oldest weekly magazine in the United States, a flagship of the political and cultural left. To mark its 150th anniversary, The Nation's archivist, Richard Kreitner, is publishing The Almanac, a daily blog on the magazine's website about what happened on that day in history and how The Nation covered it. Today on our podcast, Richard Kreitner talks about the week of May 10th to May 16th, a week that includes stories about the first woman who ran for the presidency of the United States, the death of Bob Marley, and Israel's Declaration of Independence. We interviewed Richard Kreitner from The Nation's New York offices via Skype. The interviewer is Bruce Wark.
Well, Richard Kreitner, on the podcast today, we're talking about the week of May the 10th to May 16th. And we start with May the 10th, 1872. That's coverage of Victoria Woodhull. She becomes the first woman to run for president of the United States. And what was that story about?
This was an article in The Nation from the year before that, 1871, when Victoria Woodhull was trying to get Congress to recognize women's suffrage under a very creative application of the 14th Amendment. And The Nation was responding to John Bingham's refusal to entertain that idea, and he had written much of the 14th Amendment. And they said this: "The question will probably suggest itself to many. How long are our constitutions and laws to be interpreted by man-made cast-iron rules of construction, in which no play whatever is allowed to the warm impulses, the passionate longings, the delicate fancies, the flashing intuitions, which the feminine half of humanity alone can supply?"
And so The Nation was on the side of female suffrage, but at the same time, I still see the language of the time is fairly, when they say flashing intuitions, delicate fancies, and so on, it's still fairly what we would consider sexist language today, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. The Nation supported women's suffrage for at least the first 5 or 10 years or so of its existence, and then it turned against it. But even during that time, as you note, it was only in favor of women's suffrage in fairly sexist ways.
Well, I'm surprised by them turning against it. Why did The Nation turn against the vote for women?
Well, this is a theme that will be familiar to listeners of your podcast as we go along through the weeks of the year, because The Nation turned against almost every radical, or we would say now progressive, idea that it had been founded to endorse. It turned against racial equality, women's equality, turned against labor, although labor wasn't much of an issue when it was founded in 1865. But in any case, it became very conservative and in favor of the status quo, very different from the way that it was in 1865.
Well, as most listeners to this podcast will know, that's the famous "I Shot the Sheriff" by Bob Marley and the Wailers. And Richard Kreitner, the Nation archivist, you have Bob Marley down for May 11th, 1981. What happened then?
That was the day that Bob Marley died of complications from cancer in Miami. His plane was making a stop from Germany to Jamaica, and he passed away from a cancer that was actually first discovered under his toenail, I believe. And The Nation, 3 years later, reviewed a book of about Bob Marley, a biography.
And who wrote that review?
That was by a freelance critic named George DiStefano, who about 10 years ago or so wrote a history of the mafia in America.
So could you read a bit from that review?
Sure, it's a great piece. "No great savant or leader, Marley was as confused as any of us by the maddening contradictions of life. He was, however, also a unique artist who articulated the hopes and sufferings of the poor and powerless through his direct, unaffected folk poetry and protest lyrics. Perhaps what is most significant about Bob Marley is that for a brief while, he managed to alter the terms of cultural exchange between First and Third Worlds. Until he came along, Western domination of the black West Indian psyche was near total, encompassing everything from standards for high art to gangster movies and Coca-Cola. Marley seduced Babylon with a beat and a hard-won moral authority that no pop music figure before or since has managed to achieve.
And so that was May 11th, 1981, the day that Bob Marley died, and The Nation ran that review of the book a few years later. What happened on May 12th that attracted your attention as archivist and that you decided to include in the almanac to celebrate 150 years of The Nation?
Sure. Well, that was the day in 1820 that Florence Nightingale, founder of modern nursing, was born. And, you know, alert readers will recognize that 1820 is before 1865 when The Nation was founded, but, you know, some days in history were busier than others. So I picked one from before we were founded, but The Nation did write about Nightingale in 1920 on her centennial.
Yes, I see it was by James Rorty, who was the father of the philosopher Richard Rorty.
That's exactly right. He was a frequent correspondent for The Nation for at least two decades, I believe. Actually, our almanac entry of March 22nd is an excerpt of his article that's critical of the Grand Coulee Dam that he wrote in 1941.
So he wrote this piece for The Nation in 1920, 100 years after Florence Nightingale's birth. And could you read a little bit from it?
Sure. With both hands, Florence Nightingale reached out to seize the world of reality for her sex. And there were not men in England strong enough or stupid enough or obstructive enough to stop her. Florence Nightingale was born a Victorian lady, destined, as she bitterly realized, to, quote, do crochet in her mother's drawing room, end quote, and nothing much else. She was over 30 before she succeeded in winning through to the world of reality which she craved. But in achieving at last her triumph in the face of all the outraged conventions of her time, she conquered vicariously for multitudes of her followers.
Yes, and she's credited as the founder of modern nursing, a campaigner for many social reforms, and the lady with the lamp. Richard Kreitner, May 13th, 1910, is the next event that The Nation covered. What was that?
That was the day that the great boxer Joe Louis was born.
Yes, and so I was really interested in this entry because even though The Nation was sympathetic to the fact that Joe Louis was black, nevertheless, the piece by the famous writer James T. Farrell also, as you point out, sort of racializes things a bit.
Absolutely. And I think that was, I mean, as far as I understand, that was quite common. Even, I mean, James Farrell was a real lefty radical in the 30s, at least. I think he turned to the right later on. But even in the 30s protest art, you see certainly some highly racialized depictions of black people in America.
And I think we'll hear that when you read this excerpt.
Dressed in a loud gray suit with a straw hat askew on his enormous head, Joe Louis sat bowed. The son of exploited Alabama cotton pickers, he had in 2 years earned $1 million in his so-called meteoric rise in the prize ring. He had just earned well over $100,000. Now he sat like a sickened animal. He is a large Negro boy with blowout cheeks, fat lips, and an overdeveloped neck. His face was puffed and sore. He dabbed his eyes with a handkerchief, revealing bruised knuckles. It goes on and on. I'm just going to skip ahead a bit. Photographers stood on chairs, waiting Lewis's exit, begging for just one picture. Loud cheers echoing from outside heralded Schmeling's departure. He was fighting Max Schmeling. Lewis sat, still punch drunk. He went out like a drunken man, surrounded by cops and members of his retinue, his face hidden behind a straw hat and the collar of his gray top coat. Unsupported, he would have fallen. The helpless giant was pushed into a taxi cab and hustled away, while a crowd fought with the police to obtain a glance at him.
Yes, and I think you point out that Max Schmeling beat him in 12 rounds, beat Joe Louis on that occasion, but that Louis had a comeback against Schmeling. How did that go?
That went very well. I believe he knocked him out in less than 3 minutes. James Farrell's report was about the time when Schmeling beat Louis. It was called The Fall of Joe Louis, but later on he had his revenge.
You really see the writing talent there on the part of Farrell.
Absolutely.
You're listening to a New Books Network journalism podcast. Richard Kreitner, special assistant to the publisher of The Nation, talks about The Almanac, his daily blog to mark the magazine's 150 years of continuous publishing. When Israel declared independence on May 14, 1948, The Nation was a strong backer of the Jewish state, a far cry from today when the magazine is a foremost critic of the Israeli occupation.
The Eretz Israel. Kam ha'am ha'yehudi, ba utzva dmuto haruchnit hadatit v'amdinit.
That's the voice of David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister and considered the founder of modern Israel, on a historic date, May 14th, 1948. So what would you say about the nation's coverage of the founding of modern Israel?
Well, The Nation was not only cover it from a journalistic standpoint. The Nation was one of the most avid supporters, certainly in the United States as a publication, possibly even in the world, of Israeli independence from British Mandate Palestine. The Nation submitted tons of reports to the United Nations. The Nation lobbied the Truman administration constantly to overcome some anti-Zionist skeptics in the State Department. So The Nation actually participated directly in the founding of Israel.
Yes, and could you read an excerpt from the editorial that The Nation ran on Israel's independence?
Jewish authorities have taken over most of the services. They collect taxes, they've even issued stamps for use within their boundaries, and have announced the restoration of foreign mail service. More impressive still, they have set up an agency to control the properties of Arabs who fled as the Jews took over. Businesses are being managed where possible. Vineyards and other farms are being tended and their produce used, but the assets conserved for the legal owners. This, I should say, is the final proof of an established, responsible administration. At the same time, the Jews are fighting the Arab invaders and their local allies with courage and success. That they can hold out for a long time is certain. American Army officers who have lately inspected the Jewish forces and training centers have reported a high morale and intelligent preparation. Already, Arab leaders are letting it be known that while they are committed to a holy war to blot out the Jewish state, they will also go about it gradually, accomplishing their end, as Hassan Pasha said the other day, by attrition.
Yes, you can really hear strong support there, but yet Richard, anybody who reads The Nation today will know that The Nation today is a very serious critic of Israel, to put it mildly. What happened in the years since then to change The Nation from a pro-Zionist publication to a critic of Israel?
Well, The Nation was very disappointed with the occupation after 1967. We were still writing and publishing very pro-Israel arguments well after that, well into the mid-70s. But there was an increase. I've written an entire memo about this, so it's pretty fresh in my mind. There were criticisms of the occupation through the mid-70s, saying that it would be deleterious to Israel's own security. But by around 1980 or 1981, when Christopher Hitchens came on board, actually, as I believe he was a prime mover of this shift, there was much more criticism of Israel in The Nation's pages. And in December 1981, there was a special issue called The Myths About the Middle East, co-edited by Kai Bird, who has since written, I believe, a book about his time growing up in Israel, Palestine. Which I would call the definitive moment when the Nation changed its tune.
You're listening to a New Books Network journalism podcast. Richard Kreitner, The Nation's archivist, talks about The Almanac, his daily blog to mark the magazine's 150 years of continuous publishing. Richard has selected notable events from each week of the year, along with excerpts from related Nation articles and editorials. For example, the entry for May 15th is pegged to Madeleine Albright's birth in 1937. Albright served as President Bill Clinton's ambassador to the United Nations. When Clinton named her the first female Secretary of State in 1996, a Nation editorial criticized women's groups and other backers for hailing the appointment of a hawkish pro-Israeli diplomat. As we continue our podcast, interviewer Bruce Wark asks Richard Kreitner about an event during the First World War and how the Nation covered it.
May 16th, 1918. And this, boy, Congress passes the Sedition Act. And you picked that one. The Nation ran an editorial. And again, I was very surprised by the Nation's response to a piece of legislation that I guess civil liberties groups would say really undermines civil liberties. And what did the Sedition Act do? What was it, you know, proscribing?
It limited free speech insofar as you could not utter or publish anything that was seen as seditious to the United States government.
Yeah, I see that the socialist leader Eugene Debs went to prison for a couple of years under that act for advocating for opposing conscription during
exactly.
the war.
And when we featured that day on the Almanac a few weeks ago, and it quoted an article in The Nation about Eugene Debs from, I don't remember, 1919 or 1920, and it was the great civil liberties defending Nation that we know and love.
Now, could you read us an excerpt from that editorial?
Sure. If the purpose of piling up sedition laws is to create a public atmosphere in which juries shall find it more difficult to live up to their judgment and conscience, such laws are vicious. Otherwise, they are hardly necessary. We know that the mind of the country is such today that disloyalty proved in court will be punished. But it may be asked, what harm is done by a bit of superfluous legislation? Which is what the Nation was saying the Sedition Act was. Well, there is very real harm to the extent that this practice encourages the national vice of believing that the whole duty of civilized government is in putting laws on the statute books. A vast enthusiasm for new laws and a vast indifference after their enactment is very much the American way of it. But even then, what harm? No harm, perhaps, in peace times when laws are passed amidst acclaim and forgotten. Great harm when, in wartime, laws cannot be passed without arousing fears and irritations and to no clear purpose.
Yes, a very different kind of stance than the Nation would have today, I think.
Absolutely. It feels tortured even while I'm reading it. I'm not really sure what they're getting at. They're confused.
Yeah, saying that, you know, no great harm anyway. So, yeah, it is tortured reasoning, isn't it?
Exactly.
So, in this week, May 10th to May 16th, the things you've chosen show a kind of evolution of the Nation, I think, in several ways. And we've been talking about some of those things. How would you characterize that, Richard Kreitner?
Well, I'm looking back over and I'm seeing three pieces about women. We had Victoria Woodhull in 1871 running for president. Florence Nightingale, a great social reformer. We wrote about her in 1920 on the centennial of her birth. And then we also had the coverage of Madeleine Albright. And there's no clear narrative. It shows that things rise, things fall, things change. What else did we have? We had Bob Marley, so we've got a little bit of culture coverage, which we seem to have every week. So a great array. And now also sports. I mean, a lot of people forget that there's a politics to sports as well, and a literature, and James Farrell's piece was probably my favorite of the week, despite its regrettable dabbling in the racism of its time.
And in fact, when you mention sports, the Nation does write about the politics of sports today.
We do. We have a great writer named Dave Zirin, who is probably our most popular writer these days.
Well, Richard Kreitner, thank you so much for talking about May 10th to May 16th, and thanks again.
Great, thank you. See you next week.
You've been listening to a New Books Network podcast to mark the 150th anniversary of The Nation magazine, about how America's oldest magazine covered events during the week of May 10th to May 16th. Join us again next week as the Nation's archivist, Richard Kreitner, talks about how the Nation covered notable events later in May. You can read Richard Kreitner's blog, The Almanac, on the magazine's website at thenation.com.